This is a Battle of Britain podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum.
By the time it began, the RAF was well prepared for the war in Europe, but just a few years before, the picture was very different. The force was much smaller and its equipment was obsolete. Between 1934 and 1939, the entire culture and organisation changed forever. This podcast will explore how such a radical change came about, as well as providing a snapshot of the RAF in 1939. It was clear to some during the mid-1930s that a war with Germany was inevitable. As early as 1933, Winston Churchill warned Parliament of the resurgent threat from Germany. Although this idea was initially dismissed, by 1934 the Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin was considering expansion of the Royal Air Force. In July of that year, he duly announced that the frontline strength of the RAF would be increased to 128 squadrons within 5 years through a series of expansion schemes. This proved timely, as the following year Germany announced the formation of the Luftwaffe in direct defiance of the Treaty of Versailles. By the time war broke out, the Luftwaffe was just over twice the size of the RAF. Nevertheless, by 1939, the RAF could boast 121 squadrons, including 55 in Bomber Command and 39 in Fighter Command. As the number of squadrons increased, the RAF began to outgrow its existing structure. So on the 14th of July 1936, the Air Council decided to reorganise the air defence of Great Britain into four commands: Bomber, Fighter, Coastal and Training Commands. Under this system, the individual commanding officers were responsible for planning the development of their commands, with the Chief of the Air Staff in overall control of operational policy. It is within this structure that Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding was able to prepare Fighter Command so well for the Battle of Britain. Although the size and structure of the RAF had been largely improved, the front line of the RAF still consisted almost entirely of biplanes. The newest fighter aircraft was the Gloucester Gauntlet, a single-seat biplane armed with just two machine guns and having a top speed of only 200 miles per hour. The mainstay of the Air Force at this time was the Heavy Bomber Force. The belief, grounded in the early history of the Royal Flying Corps and the Air Force, was that the bomber would always get through. It was felt that bombardment could severely alter the outcome of war, destroying the enemy's industrial base and demoralising the population. Bomber Command's main aircraft was the Hanley Page Hayford, with a speed of 150 miles per hour and a small bomb load. Although the Hayford was made ready for the forthcoming conflict, it never actually dropped a bomb in anger, and was replaced by the Armstrong Whitworth Whitley just a few days before the outbreak of war. The Whitley was slower than the Hayford, but had a significantly larger bomb load. The so-called heavy bombers of the Second World War, such as the Hanley Page Halifax and the Avro Lancaster, were still in development. In contrast, by 1939, the fighter force had largely been modernised due to the efforts of Hugh Dowding. The focus on bombers was a worry for Dowding as far back as 1934. He felt that a large bomber force was immaterial if Britain could not defend her own shores. Therefore, he set about finding replacements for the outdated biplane fighters and commissioned the first generation of monoplane fighters, the Hawker Hurricane and the Supermarine Spitfire. These aircraft were in service by 1938. Alongside developments in aircraft, new radar technology began to emerge. Its introduction would alter the way in which the air war would be fought. Again, Dowding can be credited for much of this, as well as for the development of the information sharing system that bears his name. At the outbreak of war in September 1939, Britain had 18 chain home radar stations covering the east and half of the south coast. On the 3rd of September 1939, the beginning of the Second World War, the RAF totaled 160,452 people, with a further 15,240 overseas. These people were a mixture of professionals and civilians, men and women. The professionals were the career officers and airmen who joined the RAF as full-time servicemen or as members of the Princess Mary's RAF Nursing Service. In addition, there were the RAF Reserves, the Auxiliary Air Force, the RAF Volunteer Reserve and the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. The reserves were men who had served their term with the RAF and then left. For a set number of years after leaving, they were obliged to return to RAF service if they were called. The RAF Volunteer Reserve was slightly different. This scheme was started in 1936 to train young men to fly. It was planned to recruit 800 men every year to be taught how to fly in their spare time. They would then attend a 15-day camp each year to keep their hand in. On the outbreak of war, existing members were called up and all new recruits to the RAF were for administrative purposes listed as joining the Volunteer Reserve. By 1939, the scheme had given the RAF a valuable reservoir of 63,000 men. The Auxiliary Air Force was established in 1924. In auxiliary squadrons, the aircrew were all part-timers, training a few evenings and weekends a month, as well as attending a two-week annual camp. The scheme was devised by Trenchard to provide a so-called elite corps of civilian pilots who could be called up to fight for their country. The ground crews and support staff were all full-time RAF personnel. By 1939, there were 21 auxiliary squadrons drawn from across the country. Raised at the same time as the auxiliaries, and then merged into them in 1936-37, were the RAF Special Reserve. These units were subtly different from the auxiliaries, in that about two-thirds of all staff, air and ground crews, were part-timers, and the rest permanent. This remained the case even after the merger. The final group was the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, formed in June 1939. The Royal Air Force had had women reservists as part of the predominantly Army Auxiliary Territorial Service since 1938. However, the training was not really suitable in the ATS, and gradually the female units, 48 companies with 1,700 members in all, were moved and attached to the Auxiliary Air Force until a WAF proper was finally established. They trained like the auxiliaries and when on duty received two-thirds of the pay of their male counterparts. Over 50 trades were open to the WAF, from cleaners to signallers, clerks to drivers, operations room plotters to balloon operators. In 5 short years, the RAF had progressed from a small and under-equipped force to one better prepared for another world war. New squadrons and training units had been established, new airfields built, and new aircraft factories prepared for mass production. This expansion and the change in the culture allowed the RAF to take on the number of personnel that it was going to need. It was a cultural change which would endure when the war began, with aircrew from Empire and refugees from occupied Europe adding to the ranks. These changes may have been difficult for some, but they reflect an organisation which could adapt to circumstances, often with unbelievable speed. The RAF in 1939 may not have seemed equal to the task ahead, but with the rapid production of new fighters and the call-up of thousands of men and women and the introduction of an advanced fighter control system, it was well on its way.
That was a podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum's Battle of Britain series. If you would like to learn more about the history of the Battle of Britain, why not visit the museum's Battle of Britain Hall in London, which houses the world's most comprehensive collection of aircraft that fought in the battle. The hall is open daily from 12 noon to 6 p.m.